So one more day of your tuition dollars at work. We're going to have just this. Apparently that thing still doesn't work and this is too small. Don't complain though, my nephew is going to Berkeley. I just talked to him and he has three classes. One has 600 students, another 400, another 100. So this is just 60, you know, this is extremely nice. Okay. So I did check. I mean, this is basically the water flowing uphill versus downhill. 25,000 pages, I think that water flows downhill, and only 864 pages think water flows uphill. So 25 to 1 ratio that water is indeed flowing downhill. However, that was spring of 2007, so I wanted to see if the world evolved, and it did. Apparently, water is getting quite aggressive. It's only 11,300 pages think that water flows downhill, and close to 5,220 pages think water flows uphill. Again, this is a point I made last class
both
to you guys.
Both the searches say water flows uphill.
No, here water flows uphill, water flows downhill.
Okay. I saw the web page.
Here, water flows downhill here, and then I believe, oh wait, no, this one, water flows downhill. Okay, this I don't know what that is for. Okay, I did check, But this is the point. Actually, one of the interesting things is, of course, this tells us that water is getting aggressive, but it also tells us that web is evolving, right? It also tells us that if you could use it for some purpose before, in fact, the very fact that you made it, you know, you said it loud, people will start going and putting extra pages saying, in fact, water is going to suddenly start flowing uphill. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Okay, we will get back to this in a minute. One other thing that actually this tells us, in fact, both of these tell us, is web is not made by Martians. Okay, it's not random. It's made by us. Okay, it's not just a randomly generated set of pages. What that means is you can think of web as the huge collective unconscious or subconscious. Okay, which is why you could actually do this. If in fact randomly generated sentences populate, you know, populated the documents, and randomly generated documents populated the web, then you cannot expect these things to make sense. Okay, and in fact, in a minute we'll talk about what I consider currently like three cute ideas, three big ideas in web research in general, one of which is to realize that web basically is not random, and so it can be seen as a collective subconscious of the world. Okay, unfortunately, the moment the word goes out, you know, people will start changing it. Okay, but that's a different story. In the sense that it's not, you know, web is both distributed and autonomous, so people can put any random thing they want. But at the same time, we hope that people don't have so much time on their hands that they are generating totally nonsensical pages and putting it on the web just to confuse the little kids, you know, who would check the web to find out which direction water flows. I mean, these days, in fact, kids no longer go out to play. They check it on the Google. And so, in fact, it won't be surprising if, in fact, more and more people will be influenced by these sorts of things. But it is the case that the fact that the pages are not random winds up having an important, quite an important impact on what we can do with web and what kinds of techniques seem to work. Why do they even work? Okay. By the way, administrative, so I did get this mail from somebody already completing the homework one. I did not give the name because I know that all of you will go and beat him or her up completely. But this is kind of nice. People are already working on the homeworks. This also, but I did mention, I think unfortunately the mail about it only went to the blog. It did not go to the mailing list. The way the homeworks work is I will keep adding questions. At some point of time I say this socket is closed, so this homework is ending. At this point, about a few days later, like about normally a week later, the homework would be due. Okay, that's the normal expectation. I think it's good for you guys, in fact, to do what this person did, to try and complete things, especially when the work that's discussed here is fresh in your mind. Because if you do it later, you double work. Okay, that's the thing. In some sense, making it due not every week is to make my life, and most particularly Garrett's life, easy. Because otherwise, he'll be just spending his life grading. Okay, but it's not to make your life easy. Your life would be better off if you just keep doing it as soon as the things are given to you. Mailing list and blog are set up, and I sent invitations to people to join them. If any of you actually registered after last class, maybe you did not get an invite, you know, you should send me a mail, or maybe like next week sometime after the first week crowds leave, I will redo and then reset the mailing list again, so we'll know actually who is there. But until then, that's basically been done. Okay. Any questions, administrative questions? Okay, so I said before, so last class I was going to talk about the second take, course overview take two. That's what I started talking about. But before I go there, I want to talk to you about these general patterns which really sort of permeate the course and what you do with web. And what I hope normally is, these are three things that I put together. What I would like to see is for us by the end of the semester to put together a few more of these slides. Either agree that these are enough, in fact these are the big ideas and everything is sort of subsets of these, and you know, or come up with other patterns as to where the most interesting web-oriented research is taking place and what are the places to look for. Okay, so the first one that I want to mention is finding sweet spots in computer-mediated cooperative work. Okay, it's a mouthful, but really there is no reason in the world to believe that bag of words similarity metric should work at all. Okay, it works only because you have human in the loop, and the humans would essentially know what they're looking for, and if you screw up badly, you the search engine screws up badly, they will still be able to make up for the failure. So when the human is in the loop, normally the issue is just to make sure that something not completely unreasonable is provided to them. And it's not obvious up front. You know, we do know that when the human is in the loop, the best thing to do is understand what they're looking for and just give them what they want, which is great. But we don't know how to do that. Okay? And the other extreme, of course, is to just not do anything and say, here is my crawl. You know, here are the 8 billion pages. You know, one of them is what you're looking for. And then, of course, then too, they can look through it and find out what they're interested in. Okay? Something closer to that extreme is bag of letters model that I made up last time for you guys. Okay? Instead of bag of words, bag of letters. Think of every document as just a bag of letters. And how many times the letter A appears in this, how many times the letter B appears in this, and so on. It's better than random, right? But it's still not a reasonable enough sweet spot that people would be very unhappy. Unless you have a really large alphabet in your language, people are likely to be quite unhappy if you do bag of letters. Okay, so what's interesting is how come bag of words is a good sweet spot? And finding these kinds of sweet spots where you don't have to kill yourself, okay, but you also would have reasonably satisfied humans in the loop is an interesting thing. Yes?
So the basic argument against bag of letters is that the number of characters is so small or limited that there should be redundancy?
Yeah, basically you cannot tell apart files. Okay, that's ultimately the reason. Because pretty much all files will contain all letters and more or less in similar ratios. The reason bag of words makes sense, in fact, I mean, again, I'm jumping ahead and I'm assuming, or rather I just am telling you that you should know by now, although I haven't formally described it, that bag of words model is what most search engines use as their bedrock. And if you never thought about it, it's a very stupid thing to do. You know, if you try to understand what people are telling you by taking their entire paragraph, converting it into bags of words, okay, which sometimes what I feel like when I actually look at the test, you know, exams that people have already answered, it's not going to make much sense. Okay, it's making reasonable sense partly because somebody is there. All you are doing is trying to show them where the answer might be. And if you're wrong, you know, you can just put a, I mean, you, the search engine could put a sweet face and say, yeah, mistake. Okay, so that's the point I'm trying to make here. And, you know, these are kind of the general ideas that are not techniques on which I can't ask you questions. And, you know, but these are important to see the bigger patterns. And I think, you know, I thought it would be a good idea to do it today. Okay. So bag of, now notice that if I were to do, so the extremes are completely randomly, you know, giving the entire crawl, okay, full NLP on the other extreme, full natural language understanding, because then I know what exactly you're looking for, and then I'll give you what you want. Okay, by the way, I would not even say full natural language understanding is enough. If you really want to help people, you need to be, you know, when you are their secretary, you would know them over a period of time. Okay, a classic point is basically when, even if they say a few words, you can make sense of the entire context just from those few words. It's not necessarily that people are actually going to give large, you know, paragraphs of their requests and all the time. Okay, so more than NLP, really, it's like, you know, also natural language processing plus the complete profile of the user, which is something, you know, if you have the access to, then that's the best way to help. Okay, the other extreme, as I said, is just give it a crawl, and then in that spectrum, you have random here and NLP plus full user profile for the, you know, in the other end, somewhere here is a bag of letters. This is bag of words. Now, if I'm into bags, you know, why can't I talk about bag of sentences? What do I mean by that normally? What I mean by that is, in fact, you know, think of files as made up of large phrases rather than single words, okay? So you're kind of looking, the pieces that you're looking at are increasing in size. This is just letters, this is words, this is sentences. There are many more sentences than there are words. There are many more words than there are letters. Okay, so you could think of bag of sentences. In fact, there's a variation of bag of sentences called bag of shingles. What is a shingle? A shingle is a contiguous piece of text. Okay. A K shingle is a contiguous piece of K words together. Okay, so I can think of a file now as the first K words is one shingle, starting from the second letter to another K words is another shingle, and so on. Okay, if you do that, obviously you can distinguish between more files this way. Okay, but, you know, I'm not necessarily saying there is a natural progression from here to full natural language processing. You know, that's obviously not the case. In fact, there's another way of thinking about language processing, which is, you know, taking the grammar into account and parsing the sentences and so on and so forth. But my point is that in way of going like this, why is it that so many search engines can make such a fast buck with just a bag of words? Doing more than is needed is not necessary, at least in a sort of, it's great from a research point of view, but it's not necessary from being the fastest search engine right now, or the best search engine right now, okay? So that's something that I want you to look for in every problem that you look for. What's the sweet spot, okay? That is sort of, you know, you could think of it as the lazy way out. Find the least you can do to get the maximum out. But, you know, because the humans are in the loop, there are these kinds of sweet spots. The second big idea that I want you to think of, I just call them big ideas because I wrote them, but, you know, you could come up with these kinds of patterns hopefully too. And, you know, I would love to hear from you either, you know, right after this class or over the period of the semester. Now, what would be nice is to look back at these at the end of the semester and see if there are other things we can think of, okay? Is collaborative computing or brain cycle stealing or computizing eyeballs, okay? Basically, all that means is the point that I made last time, that huge number of humans are looking into the onto the web, and they have nothing really to do. So if, and they have brains, and if we can somehow use those brains for your work, okay. How many of you know the Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy, according to which essentially all of us are a huge big experiment that was set up to find out the meaning of life, right? So that's basically what we should be doing in some sense, somehow make people do the work for you. And the Tom Sawyer effect that I mentioned last time, the Louis Wanans, ESP games kinds of things, you know, all of these are great ideas. Okay. Now, basically, so you can have collaborative knowledge compilation, which is Wikipedia, collaborative curation, collaborative tagging, you know, all of these. Now, problem, of course, is when you allow lots and lots of people to do these things, they can also screw up. So, in fact, in the case of Tom Sawyer, I mean, what if one of these kids doesn't know how to paint and started blotching up the wall? Now, it turns out that fences, nobody really cares. As long as they look sort of painted, you're happy enough. Okay, but when you have large number of people do this stuff for you, they can also screw up. So how do you make sure that, you know, after you have all this collaboration happening, how do you make sure that what was put up there was in fact correct out of the box? This is exactly the point that we made in the ESP game thing. In fact, when Amazon came up with, there were like two problems with the way Amazon tried to think of annotating the images. One is they were paying people on a per image basis. If you annotate it, you'll give you money. Two is what stops people from taking 25 cents and writing junk, right? So they were going to check. That's totally nonsensical. If you have a billion pages and, you know, billion people looked at each one of them and checked, and then you, I mean, and then annotated, and you sit down and check them all, you're dead. Right? You need another billion people to check this, which is not going to go anywhere. Right? So in fact, what's interesting about the Louis Wanan thing that I mentioned last time is the game is set in such a way that if two random people agree on a particular word as describing a randomly shown image, there's a very high chance that that's in fact. So you need to think of, you know, when you have to do this kind of thing, you have to find a way of self-stabilization methods, you know, which, you know, look for correctness and so on. You know, in fact, but in the case of tagging, what happens is that other people, so in the case of Wikipedia, for example, other people will undo the changes you do, you know, if in fact these changes are bad. But that's still quite, you know, you cannot have too many Wikipedias going around. Wikipedia works very well, but, you know, a lot of people try to do the same thing for specialized areas, Wikipedia for physics, Wikipedia for computer science. They don't seem to work anywhere near as well. Because most people don't know, first of all, that area. And second of all, it doesn't seem to have the same amount of return on investment for people. Okay? So this is, it's a great direction, but, you know, making ideas that work in that is actually very tricky. Okay? And then the last one I mentioned earlier is to realize that web is in fact not random. The pages, the content is essentially generated by some sentient human being, some of whom you probably won't consider sentient, but they are sentient, okay? And so in essence, you can, by looking for syntactic patterns on the text in the web pages, you could still actually find patterns that really hold true in the world for that we inhabit. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's something that, again, so analyzing term co-occurrences in the web scale corpora to capture semantic information. Okay, so for example, one big thing is you would see that if two words seem to be occurring together pretty much all the time in, you know, in documents, then they must be closely related. Now this makes sense with respect to a generative model that you have in mind as to how web was generated to begin with. Okay, and part of the reason they work as well as they do is because most of these pages are being generated by humans and are meant for consumption by humans. And so the patterns you, the search engine or the search data miner finds on this will still make sense to humans. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind. So you know, analyzing the term co-occurrences, analyzing the link structure of the web graph, that too, for example, the whole page rank deal makes sense because when I put a link to somebody, I tend to respect them normally. That's kind of a mark of respect. Okay, if links are randomly generated, then page rank shouldn't make any sense. Okay, so keep these in the back of your mind and look for more of these, and you can yell at me also for these as actually being deep at all. That's fine too. But I will stop with the three ideas there, and then we'll go back to what we were doing last time, which is complete a brief discussion of the take two of the course, and then start talking about information retrieval, which is the main topic today. Okay, so we talked about, this is sort of a quick review, we talked about web can be viewed as a collection of various things, and depending on what you think is a collection of, it is a text, structured data, semi-structured data, and so on, then you can do different kinds of things with it, and the question of course is how do you do it, and it depends on whether you really think it's made up of text or semi-structured or structured. And then we talked about the whole point of structure, why it's so important, and mentioned that the thing that matters ultimately for us is structure helps in giving better answers. You can, you know, deal with a larger set of queries and give better answers. So for example, as I said, this is something that, you know, a keyword search engine can handle. This too, by the way, is something that keyword search engine can handle. All it does is it converts it into a bag of words. So it loses the entire meaning of the sentence. Okay? And then this one is sort of, so this is fully structured, it's more like data record kind of thing. This one is more like the keyword search, and this is sort of in between. It has some part which has structure, some part which have keywords. Okay? And then if, and since structure is so important, in fact many things we do are to improve the answers we give to the users. That's the way of thinking about it. So even the data mining, you know, you do to improve the answers. Okay? And in fact, link mining will improve the answers because you are likely to give more important pages. And user profile mining is important because you tend to realize what they mean by the keyword they have in mind. So for example, the classic thing that all of you would wind up reading at some point or other when you read enough information into your papers is that for most people in North America at any rate, and probably for the rest of the world, a large part of the rest of the world too, the keywords Michael Jordan are meant to bring up Michael Jordan, the basketball player webpage. Okay? But for most people who work actually in information retrieval, if they ask Michael Jordan, they expect to see Michael Jordan, the researcher who works at UC Berkeley, and has done great work in machine learning and you know, things related to information retrieval too. Okay? Now, how can you tell that? And part of the way you tell that is the words are exactly the same. It's the context, it is the profile of the user. Okay? So if you mine the profile of the user, you can improve the answers you can give to them. Okay, now, so, and also if you have the structure, then you can give better answers. And then I pointed out that if you don't have structure already, you can try to convert unstructured text into some structured data. And we talked about the three possibilities. One is you could hope that originally the text was actually used to live as structured data, and it was just anglicized or put into some pseudo language, in which case you want to unwrap it. Okay? And that's a wrapping technology. Those are called wrappers. Okay, and we'll talk about it. Now, the interesting thing about them is they're essentially parsing a word and converting it to a different structure. They're sort of parsers. Okay, and so a wrapper. So remember the sentence that I mentioned last time was: if you have a database of countries and their capitals, and the one tuple said India, New Delhi, and then the pseudo language, pseudo sentence that was made up would look something like, the capital of India is New Delhi, okay? And then the wrapper could be as simple as start at the beginning of the sentence, skip, 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 pick, skip, pick, okay? And then the first one is the country name, second one is the city name, Now, of course, it can fail, you know, all sorts of things. So, in fact, one of the usual things that happens is somebody would say, well, I should change it into language in a slightly different way. I should put a comma here, or I should, you know, put an extra article here. And then the wrappers fail. Okay, so we'll talk about how to do that, but you know, that's one way of adding structure, you know, bringing the structure back. The other is to extract the structure. Okay, the idea is you can use quasi NLP techniques of the kind that we talked about last time, but we'll again go into details later, or say that this is English to make sense to humans who read it, and there is a version that is supposed to make sense to machines. Already we have that, right? But for every page, there is a page and there's a source of the page. The source of the page actually makes much more sense for parsing the HTML structure and so on. Okay. And the semantic web idea is that there's yet another thing essentially which has a logical description of the page in some formal language. Okay. And then if you have that, then you may be able to use that structure. Okay. Those are some things. And so the extraction of structure winds up playing a big part. And then the areas that we will wind up being involved with in this course are basically four areas: information retrieval, social network analysis, databases, data mining. Okay, and these are all traditional areas which had their own lives, and then we basically wind up using them for solving our problem, okay, which is supporting web search, supporting what we want to do with the web. Okay. So what I would like to do is sort of quickly go through, and this is actually a summary of the next four slides that I'll go through. Okay. So in the case of information retrieval, which we'll come back to in a minute for more serious discussion, essentially the traditional problem is given a set of documents and a set of key and a set of keywords, you're supposed to return a ranked list of these documents that you think are most relevant to the query. And this area existed before. Okay. In fact, they used to have a conference called IR, Information Retrieval, and after ACM became popular enough, they started having a version. They kind of had, you know, ACM Special Interest Group, and it became SIG-IR. And most people would not go to this conference. Nothing used to happen there. Mostly librarians would go there, and it was a nice backwater. Now you can't get to the conference. It gets, you know, it's one of the hardest conferences to actually get a paper into, or one of the biggest attended conferences. Why? Because what was traditional information retrieval winds up being very useful to web search engines, and so, you know, you wind up, that's again, it has a second life altogether. However, so we will understand what traditional model of information retrieval is all about, and we'll also talk about why it becomes easier versus harder when you adapt it to web search. Okay. The interesting point is that when you apply information retrieval in the context of web as against in the context of traditional model, the traditional model is, how many of you have heard things like LexisNexis? If you hear NPR, you would hear it because they are one of the few people who support NPR. And so they will say sponsored by LexisNexis. It's essentially a search engine based on traditional information retrieval models, and it existed forever and ever. And what they do is they would abstract, essentially, they will index, you know, special papers in, you know, variety of areas, you know, in legal briefs or in biology and so on and so forth. And then you could, they would support keyword search over them. Their general interest is that they don't, the one very important thing in traditional information retrieval is that the keywords are special words. They don't actually have to be present in the document. And not everything in the document is a keyword. Not every keyword is a word in the document. And this is actually the way you understand keywords now, right? For example, even though in search engines, you put any random thing that comes to your head and say, search for it, if you go to Tempe Library or if you go to Noble Library, when they say keywords, you can't just put random combinations of words. They have only certain things are considered reasonable keywords. Right. For example, you may be able to search for westerns, okay, but you may not be able to search for cowboy movies. Even though they are very connected, and I'm sure search engines will give you the similar answer for westerns and cowboy movies. Okay, but in normal traditional libraries, there won't be an index called a keyword called cowboy movies, unless they started, you know, moving on with the times. Okay. So, and then basically they have fewer keywords, and then you're supposed to know what is the keyword you're looking for, and then you ask that, and then they will give you the most relevant documents with respect to that. That's what you've been used to doing, you know, in these card catalogs that you pull out in the old days, even before computers, and even now when there are computers in the libraries, that's what they do. Okay. When you come to the web, there are a bunch of headaches. First of all, scale. There's way too many documents. And there is no kind of a overseeing authority on these documents. Any random person can make a document, okay? Whereas to get into library, you need to actually publish it, which means you need an ISBN number, right? And not any random person can just write a book and get an ISBN number. I mean, you can actually, but it takes a while. So that in itself acts as a filter. Okay, whereas here any of us can put a page on the web, so it increases the number of possible things that you have to search over. The other thing is the connections between documents are there, which is actually, this is a headache, there's a scale. Another headache is actually the user. Web users tend to be way more impatient sorts of people than people who actually go to library. Most of the web users don't go to library, right? It's very boring. You know, you actually have to stand, look for what you're looking for, and then even those who go to library, how many of them actually talk to a human reference librarian to ask for something that they want? What web users tend to do is ask a keyword query whose average length tends to be 2.3 words long and expect miracles out of it. How could you not know what I'm looking for? Okay, so you have this problem. So a very non-homogeneous list, group of users, some of who want the basketball player for Michael Jordan, some of who want Michael Jordan the professor, and some of who want something completely different. Okay, but there are also simplifications in the context of web. It turns out that in the traditional information retrieval, documents do refer to each other, but very indirectly. They refer to each other by putting footnotes. Okay, on the web, the most direct form of reference is a href. For computers, it's extremely easy to follow hrefs from place to place. So there was always a network before between documents. Documents are connected to each other, they cite each other, and in fact, the whole notions of page ranks, authorities, hubs, and so on came from bibliometrics, where essentially professors always wanted to, because they don't get much money anyway, they would want to see who is the most cited of you all, of us all, and then I must be the smartest guy because most people seem to be smart, citing my work. Okay, and when you put a link to somebody's page, in some sense, you're citing their page. Except citations in a document are somewhat harder to find, but it's easy for humans, but it's harder to find for the machines without extraction, whereas it's easier to do with just hyperlinks. Okay, so that network is there, and you can use that network to great advantage. And then, on the other hand, and one more simplification is it's actually easier to please the lay user. The flip side of people who ask 2.3 word queries is that they're happy with pretty much anything. Okay, they know that they can't be bothered to ask a reasonable query. They also know that they'll get what they pay for, which is anything, essentially. Whereas the traditional LexisNexis kind of engines. Would have, for example, a physician sitting there and typing a paragraph about the kind of abstract that they're looking for. And then you're trying to find something closely related to that. Okay? In fact, in the traditional retrieval, the query is considered a document. Because you can write so big, a query is itself considered a document. And so you compare documents to documents. That's the view. Okay, so query is just a mini document. Web, basically, not only don't people write documents in searching for documents, in fact, search engines actively stop you from writing more than about 10 words. If you write more than 10 words, they ignore the rest. Okay, so there are things that become easier, there are things that become difficult. So consequently, obviously there are things that we have to deal with. For example, because we have the link structure, we can use that to figure out which of the books are the most important books, which of the pages are the most important pages, to some extent. And then because the scale is so darn high, indexing and retrieval becomes extremely important. Fast retrieval. Nobody has any time to wait Okay, so if the search engine doesn't respond in a couple of seconds, you move on, or you hit again. Okay, so the idea is you need very fast indexing techniques, and of course retrieval depends on the indexing. So if you do very smart and very fast indexing, many things that you are sort of reasonably impressed with, such as when you say a word, the search engine says, "Do you mean this maybe?" and it will correctly spell it. It's actually based on indexing. Okay, you would wind up indexing near misses along with the words, so that you can very quickly figure out. I mean, because not too much thinking can be done after the query has been submitted. Okay, by the search engine, and so everything that they want to show has to have been pre-done beforehand and indexed. So indexing is a huge important topic. Okay, and so is of course ranking. Now, social networks. As I said, traditional model is, of course, it was true in the normal information retrieval, there was not much of a link structure between documents. Although there was this whole notion of citations, etc., that evolved as a separate literature called bibliometrics. Okay, social networks actually subsumes that to some extent, and that's basically connections between entities, especially in the social world, between people and between documents if they are citing each other and so on. And if you have these kinds of networks, you can have measures of centrality and importance. You can decide which is the most central node in a network, in the sense every path seems to go through that node. Most of the paths seem to go through that node. Okay. Now the word hub actually means, you know, there is a word called authorities and hub, right? A hub basically is this view of, you know, taking everything into one place. And then so everybody brings all their stuff to that place, and from there it goes to wherever it is needed. Okay, and hub models are extremely useful in FedEx, for example. The other day I got something from Amazon, and I found that it was in San Diego, went to Kentucky, and came to me. Okay, because that's cheaper for them. Okay, because everybody goes to, I think Memphis actually is the FedEx hub. Everything goes to Memphis. It doesn't matter if you are right next to San Diego. You know, beyond a little distance, beyond San Diego, they'll take you to Memphis. Not you, your documents. Now, the way the prices are going, at some point of time, they want to do it to us too. Okay, this business of nonstop flights is not going to sustain itself, and so either you have to pay more, or you all go to one place and come back from that. And then Memphis, all of a sudden, Memphis is the central node. You know, I mean, I guess what's his name, Elvis Presley is there, but beyond that, what has happened in Memphis? Nothing, right? Right? I mean, I hope none of you are from Memphis, but but it's still a central node. So the centrality is different from importance. Everything passes through Memphis; it never stays there. Okay, So, and where do they stay? They mostly stay maybe in New York and hopefully in Phoenix, at least I would like to hope so, and then Washington DC and so on. So that's why you have the notions of measures of centrality and importance. Memphis is central in the FedEx hub network, but it's not important because not everything is stopping there. You know, they wind up stopping in some other place. Yes, sir. That's a good point. It depends on, that's a different kind of, in fact, Memphis will wind up being a hub in that sense because many things start from there and go. Okay, so actually take a related issue is, you know, those of you who read papers, I mean, not the newspapers, the technical paper kind, you could have original papers and you can have survey papers. Okay, survey papers take an entire area and try to write what is happening. I mean, in fact, that's a popular term paper stuff that people do, you know. Good survey papers are extremely hard to write, but bad survey papers are very easy to write, okay? And so lots of students, when they are running out of ideas for term papers, say, I can do a survey paper, you know, I'll take a couple of sentences from this and citation, couple of sentences from this, citation. But the really good survey papers, like good textbooks, would require you to understand everything and write together. Now, survey papers, the best ones, will get lots of citations. Why? Because if you get to that page, you will know where to go to. Okay, original papers get citations, but so do survey papers. Okay, it's the same sort of a thing. So Memphis is sort of a survey paper, you know, in the FedEx analogy, because it, once you get there, it tells you, you know, what are all the ways. Many, many things start from there, for example. Okay. So, and then, you know, social networks have been used in lots and lots of ways. Social network analysis has been used in lots and lots of ways. We'll talk about it. In all of these cases, information retrieval, the first topic we'll talk about starting today, we'll first talk about the traditional model and talk about how to extend it to web service, you know, web search. And similarly, we'll talk about social networks, and the web-induced headaches for social networks are scale, of course, billions and billions of entities, you know, depending on which social network you're looking at, network between people, network between documents, and so on and so forth. And then something that's always been hard is implicit versus explicit links. So for example, if you put a hyperlink, it's easier to follow for a computer. But if you say, you know, Rao's page is so great and don't put a hyperlink, then somebody in between has to understand that sentence and convert it into an href. And when you, in fact, many of these bibliography search engines, such as Google Scholar, when they index the PDF files, they essentially extract the citations from the PDF. That's a structure extraction. Okay, and they're able to then look at what they extracted and say which paper is it referring to and convert it into an actual machine readable link. Okay, that way they actually, now they have both for themselves as well as for you, they have an easy way of traversing the social network. Yes, sir. You could call it, I mean, extracting, I mean, I won't go into that distinction, we can talk about it outside, but extraction essentially means you're getting that, you know, the extraction, the word is more general, we'll talk about it later, but it's still not full NLP. If you can do full NLP, you know, all of this just fall as a simple byproduct. Okay, simplification. One big, big, big difference about social networks is of the human kind and the social networks of the machine kind, really, is that oftentimes there is somebody who knows the entire social network in the machine kind. Okay, the search engine knows the entire social network among all the pages, if you think of the citation links. Your favorite social networking site knows all your friends, their friends, their friends, 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 friends. They just say, we won't tell anybody. But they know. Somebody knows the entire social network. In the normal, until that happened, right now, if I need to find a common friend between me and, you know, and somebody who I really want to talk to, I need to figure that out. If it's one link, it's hard enough. If it's five links, it's pretty painful. The most interesting aspects of social networks, actually, in fact, the traditional social networks, come from the fact that the network is distributed. The knowledge of the network is distributed. You know who your friends are. I don't necessarily know who your friends are. I know you, I know you, so I can come and ask you, do you know this person? Okay? Search engines don't have to do that. They know all the pages and how all of them point to each other. So the measures of centrality are much easier to compute for social networks that are basically machine readable, in essence. Okay, that's actually a big advantage. How many of you know the Milgram's experiment, the Kevin Bacon game, Milgram's experiment, all these things? We'll talk about it later. But if you know about it, think of this particular point, which is Milgram's experiment would not be interesting at all, which should not be surprised at all. So what Milgram did was he essentially, I mean, it's a botched up experiment, but what they did was, you know, about 40s, I think, or 50s, the psychologist gave a bunch of letters to a bunch of people in one Midwestern town and said they need to go to a particular organization or a person in Boston. And all you can do is to give this letter to somebody that you know and ask them to give it until it reaches. This is a way of simulating the social network. You can only give it to people that you know. Right? Of course, you can say, who the heck is this asking all these questions and throw away the letters. In fact, most letters were thrown away. They never reached anywhere. Okay. What was interesting in the Milgram's experiment is a reasonably large percentage of letters did finally reach the destination. And so you can then talk about small world phenomena. Everybody seems to know everybody and all that fun stuff. it's one thing saying that after seeing, another thing exploiting it beforehand. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, this is the whole business of coincidences. The moment coincidence happened, oh my God, this coincidence happened. You can't plan for the darn thing. Okay? So, whereas, if you have the entire network in front of you, you can plan the path. You know, this is what you should do. Go from here to here, here to here, here to here. It's just a simple path planning. Okay? So there are things that become easier, there are things that become harder. And we'll go into it. We'll talk about the traditional social networks and, you know, how they become easier or harder to deal with in the context of web. Okay? Now, how do you use it? You can use it, obviously, in ranking. You can also use it in recommendations. For example, you know, people who seem to share your, you know, kinds of interests might have our interest in it. In fact, recommendations are less. Actually, one point is that just because my friend liked a particular piece of music, that doesn't necessarily mean I would like it. Normally, it's probably the opposite. In fact, if my, you know, there's only one course in my entire life I dropped, and that's the area my wife works in, and there's only one course that my wife thought was sort of laughable, and that is the area I work in, okay? And we still are actually married, and maybe that's the reason we are married, okay? So the point, of course, is that the recommendations may not actually work as well for social networking. But there are other things that do work. So, for example, trust is something that will go on the social networks. So I still, in fact, recently I needed to tell one of my students whether or not they should consider taking a class that's being offered by somebody in her department. So I asked her, do you think it's worth doing it? And, you know, she said, no, not really worth it. And, you know, I told them that, okay? So trust does follow on the social networks, and so you can use that. Okay. Integration. Integration, traditional model basically is, if you have a database, basically you can answer queries on the database. It's very boring stuff, you know, if you are not into databases, but it's great stuff compared to keyword query ideas, right? Because you actually have structure to the tuples, and you can ask selection queries, you can ask projection queries, you can ask join queries and all that stuff, and you can answer all of them efficiently. And that's the whole point of traditional database research. And those of you who are done 412 know all about this, okay? And then the evaluation is that the answer for a query is pre-specified. Basically, there's only one answer for each query in a database, in a normal database, okay? And so since there is only one answer, the only way you can distinguish yourself from other people, if you are a database manager, is be fast at giving that answer. So speed is the most important thing. Response time is the most important thing. Now, if you have huge number of databases, all of them are sitting all over the web, okay, there are variations of this, of course, like distributed databases kind of comes to mind, federated databases come to mind, but what happens when you have databases on the web, there can be many, many of them. They can all have differing schemas, so they call the same column with different names. Or what is one single column here becomes two different columns here. Okay, so they're having same kinds of information, but you don't notice it. Okay, furthermore, they can be partially complete. None of these databases have all the information about a particular query. So you have to combine the answers from multiple databases. They can be overlapping. This heterogeneous schemas winds up being like a killer thing because they all have different schemas. And just mapping the schemas is the first thing. Once you don't map the schemas, you're in trouble. You can't actually answer queries. Okay. Then you can have access limitations. Those of you, have you ever tried asking Amazon, just send me the list of all your books? Try it. You know, just give me all your books. Okay? If you have a relational database in front of you, you can say, give me everything. And it will give you everything. Okay? Databases on the web obviously will restrict your access to all sorts of ways. They won't even let you. For example, try asking Amazon, give me all the books which have 748 pages. Right? They know it. Why don't they give it to you? Right? If you have a database of books, you would know exactly which books have 748 pages. How come they don't tell you? They won't let you ask that question. Okay? Now, suppose your life depended on finding out what are the books that have 748 pages. What do? You give huge number of queries to Amazon, keep selecting the ones which have exactly 748 pages. So whatever they give, ignore the title, ignore the genre, ignore everything. Just look at the pages. You're the pages person. And if it's 748, answer. Otherwise, it's not an answer. I'm not joking. This is actually what I just did is query rewriting. I had a query which is get me all the books which have 748 pages. It's a legitimate query. You shouldn't have stopped me from asking that. Since you stopped me from asking that, I will find a way of rewriting my query into legitimate queries which you will let me get answers for and find the answers. Okay, that's the kind of thing that you might wind up doing. And then of course, because the database are outside on the web, then there is unreliability aspects of the networks and so on and so forth. So consequently, we need to consider models of databases you have to consider the questions of schema mapping. You have to consider how to register multiple databases onto a common schema. You need to consider newer notions of completeness. There is no such thing as all answers must be given. It's a question of if you have two database engines on the web, one gives 10 answers in 3 seconds and then it stops, and another gives 1,000 answers but after 2 days. Which is better? The point is, some people might like the first, some people might like the second, and you need to be able to actually optimize for both. You need to be able to optimize for both the response time and the coverage and the quality and everything else. Okay. Furthermore, of course, as we already mentioned during the extraction point of view, these databases may not have existed as databases at all. It was all already anglicized, and so you had to extract the information from the databases. Now the extraction can be iffy, and so you thought extracted something, and it basically said capital of India, new. Because there is a New Delhi, there is a space after new, and you know, if it's a bad wrapper, it just looks for the first word after the skip. Okay, so capital of India is new, and which could be news for a lot of people. But the point is, how do you know? I mean, so for example, the extracted piece of information is probabilistic; it's no longer deterministic. So you need to consider probabilistic databases. Okay, and so you can have lots of fun going that direction. And then finally, this is something that we have talked about in the back of our mind all the time, which is extraction involves looking for patterns, you know, looking for hyponym patterns and, you know, computing their accuracy. Importance involves looking for patterns on the page. Importance involves looking for patterns on the social network of the pages, the linked network of the pages. Then what else? The improving search results for a user, you know, being a good radar of MASH involves keeping track of what the user has been doing in the past and mining patterns in that in trying to recommend them pages. And, you know, the first time around, if it's okay for them to show 2 results, Michael Jordan, the basketball player, Michael Jordan, the professor, one after other, but after 500 times, they still show the same thing, then you will get reasonably tired. Now the question, of course, is how do they mine? They need to have a session with you, okay? They need to have a way of keeping track of your patterns of buying, your patterns of viewing queries, and this is a very interesting kind of mining. It involves mining usage patterns, mining usage logs, mining the user click patterns, and so on. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, because essentially what you're trying to compute there is user's relevance function without asking the user what the heck do you really want. Okay, and you're mining that relevance function in doing this. Okay, so again, so there are headaches, but there are opportunities in using the normal traditional data mining, machine learning ideas in the context of web search. Okay, so those are the kind of 4 things. The areas from which we'll draw our material from, the traditional version and how to extend it. That's the course. Question. Okay. And after this, you'll know whether or not this is the course for you, and you can, you know, next week if I don't see you, I would have known that I explained to you that this is not what you're looking for. Okay. So now what I'll do in the next 15 minutes, starting from today, we'll talk about information retrieval, which was the first of those slides. Okay, so essentially, do I have this here? Yeah. So remember this, I just mentioned this to you. So traditional model and how to deal with the web-induced headaches. And if you are an IR expert already, at least I don't have to explain this to you. But unfortunately, I assume you're not yet, not all of you are yet IR experts. So I'll explain what the traditional model is and then how to extend it. Okay. So what's information retrieval? You know, in a way, you guys know because you're using it. What I'll try to do is to make you realize some crazy things about information retrieval that make it so different from database retrieval, which also you do sometimes. Okay, that's part of what we will try to do today. Okay, so what information retrieval is trying to do is, given a large repository of documents, okay, how do I get the ones that I want? That's basically the problem that IR is trying to solve. Okay. Now, normally what I want is I should tell you what I'm looking for and the search engine has to go and find the documents for me. Okay? Now, it's kind of mentioned it multiple times, but normally traditional information retrieval, including the one on web, basically are keyword based. You give a bunch of keywords and you search for, and then the system looks for documents that are most relevant to those keywords. Okay, how it actually looks for them is something that we'll start talking about next week onwards. But today we'll just ask, is the problem well defined? Okay, the first thing before you ever solve a problem is to ask yourself, if I'm done, will I know it? Okay, if I'm done, and if I'm actually, you know, solve the problem, would I know that I've solved the problem? And information retrieval is a tricky point because, as you'll see, in the case of database retrieval, if you know whether or not, you can easily tell whether or not you have designed a database manager that's sound and complete. In the sense, it gives all the tuples that are answers to all possible queries and only those tuples for those queries. But information retrieval is not like that because you are asking, so this picture is interesting and the most important part is this, that fuzzy cloud, okay? The human is thinking about something in, you know, either they're very aware of what they're thinking about, sometimes they have no clue what they're thinking about. And they think, you know, even if I don't know, let me just write a couple of words and they write a query. Okay? And so they, in this case, they may or may not even know what they're looking for. But let's assume they know what they're looking for, but then they wrote this couple of words which may or may not actually imply what they're looking for. Okay. And then you have a bunch of documents here. And what a normal IR system does is thinks of these as bags of index terms. And somehow it is comparing these words to these index terms and giving a ranking of the document. The surprising thing is that this is a discipline, and that it actually is a respectable discipline and it makes sense, right? Because you are completely ignoring the structure of the documents. You're completely ignoring what it is that the user might actually be looking for. Why should it make sense at all? So much of what I will do in today's class is to try to convince you that IR should almost not make sense. And the only reason it makes sense is because of those big ideas that we looked at, one of which is web is not random at all. Okay, but let's do that step by step. So in principle, even if in fact this guy converted, this guy or girl converted their information need into well-specified natural language, okay, that in itself is still a hard problem. Okay, the hardest is even humans don't know how to deal with other humans who come and start, I am looking for something, and then they would be looking for something, but they'll be trying to say something else. I will, when I go home, I will send you this hilarious story from Woody Allen about this guy who comes to Abraham Lincoln, it's a made-up story, asking for help, and it turns out that he is like intimidated by the presence of Abraham Lincoln. He comes to Lincoln to ask for forgiveness for his son who deserted Civil War. This is a made-up story, okay, maybe it's based partly on reality. Civil War, and he was going to be hanged, and he came to ask the Lincoln for pardon. And those days, by the way, people could just walk into the White House. This much is for true. I'm not that old, but I've read about it. And so then basically Lincoln say, and so because he's intimidated, when he asked what's your question, he says, I want to know how long should a man's legs be? Right? When you're intimidated, you do all sorts of crazy things, right? So, and then of course, Lincoln gives an extremely funny answer, says long enough to reach his torso. Okay, and then he goes home and he tells his wife in this story that, look, I was so funny today in office, and you know, somebody came and asked, and he said this. And then first of all, Mary Lincoln tells him that that's the wrong way to tell the joke. They should be long enough to reach the ground, not the other way around. Point one. And point two, do you have any sense as to what he might actually be looking for? And then he starts wondering. And then, of course, because it's a story, he completely realizes, just by ratiocination, that this guy must have come to get a forgiveness for his child. Okay? And the point I'm trying to make is, even in fact, if you understand natural language, answering queries is hard. Okay? And we don't even understand natural language in IR. We're just looking for keywords, and we, the guy who's asking the query doesn't know what they're actually really looking for. Okay, and so in principle it's at least NLP, but NLP cannot be done yet, so IR tries to get by with syntactic methods. Okay, now there's a catch-22 here. Since everybody knows that IR systems don't really understand English, they no longer ask long queries. They don't ask well-specified sentences. You always are like under tremendous stress to make grammatically correct sentences. The moment you know the search engine doesn't care, you start writing all sorts of, cut pieces, right? So it's a catch-22. And after a while, you start saying, anyway, the whole thing is sunk, so why write 15 words when I can just say two words? Okay, so because of this, essentially, on the web in particular, the queries become smaller and smaller, expectations become larger and larger. Okay, but even in traditional information retrieval, you can actually, even if you give an entire paragraph asking for what you're looking for, ultimately what it's doing is comparing those keywords to those index terms. Okay, now so the information versus data, we talked about the point that in the databases, it's very clear what an answer is. You must get, this is actually wrongly done. There's something wrong with this slide, let me just skip over this. But the point is, in the data retrieval, you know exactly what are the records that are answered for a particular SQL query. And you're supposed to give all of them, and no more and no less. Okay, and all that matters is giving them fast. In the information retrieval, you're trying to make this guy happy. All that matters is making this guy happy, or this girl happy. Okay, and this is just the middleman. In fact, sometimes people are happy if the search engine gives them what they're looking for, even though they actually ask for something different by misspelling it or something. Right? So what are you trying to optimize? You're not, what you can, as a computer scientist, what you can try to do is try to optimize this ranking. But really the evaluation is with respect to whether or not this bozo is happy in the end. Okay? And bozos being happy is computed in terms of precision and recall that we'll talk about in a minute. Okay? So really what you want in IR system is interpret the contents of information items, generate a ranking which reflects the relevance, and give the documents in the order of relevance to the user. The big point, of course, is relevance. Figure out what is the user's relevance metric. It doesn't matter what he or she said. What you want is what are they really interested in. Okay, so the relevance metric can be thought of, if you are into it, it's a function, okay, for a given document and the query. Given the query Q, how relevant is document D for the user? And in fact, since the relevance metrics for different users would be different, you have to say RDQU. Relevance of the document to this user U, given this query Q. This is what you're trying to compute. And if you have it, it's a computer science problem. Because then you just have to rank it with respect to that. Okay, so let's see how you will go about getting the relevance function. So, you could do the reasonable things. One is you can try to learn the relevance function from the user by interacting with the user either actively or passively. You can try to understand what it is that the user really likes and, basically learn that function from examples of past behavior of the user. Okay, Now, in this particular case, so learning can be two types. Active is utility elicitation. So you ask questions in particular to the user. So is this the thing you're looking for? Is this the thing you're looking for? And then the other is passive, which is don't ask user any questions. Just look at what they have done. Now, the tricky part about this is how much time do people spend on a search engine per episode? Very little. How do you keep track of somebody's history when they don't want to leave trace? So what's the real reason Gmail is important? Not to help you guys check your mail. Gmail requires you to be signed on Google all the time. And it is a pretty big, I'm paranoid. But even for me, it's painful to start a separate browser and ask my queries in that browser. So more often than not, I am signed in a browser, and in the same browser, thanks to Firefox and so on, you have 15 windows open, and you know, another of the windows, you're doing a search. And Google says, oh, Rav is interested in this sort of stuff. And they will say, okay, so now I go and I ask, delete all my history. I say, oh, sure. Okay. We deleted it. Now you don't have to forget about it. No. Right? The most important thing that Gmail, you know, has really accomplished for Google is getting users to be sticky. Okay? So that you can tell over a period of days what sorts of things are they looking for. So there is no user profile if the user keeps coming in as a completely new session every time. Okay? I'll come back to this. Okay, so that's what they did. Basically, the passive thing to make it work at all, you needed the Google Mail kind of things. But obviously, that's just one part of it. Okay, you do realize that when you're logged in versus when you're not logged in, the answers to queries change. Okay, that's one idea, learning the user's relevance metric. The second idea is make up the user's mind. You know, you are a bozo, you come in and you're saying, man, I'm looking for something. And you say, yeah, you really want this car. You know, I know your kind of type, you know, your kind of swashbuckling kind of a guy needs this really big testosterone-laced car. You know, you should buy it. And it hasn't had too many repairs. Okay? This is exactly what used car salespeople do. Okay? When you go into a used car depot, you don't tell them exactly what you're looking for. And you start off buying various kinds of cars based on that. They profile you and they try to give you the car that they really want to get rid of. Okay? Right? So that's making up user's mind, which is used car salespeople. Or in general, a combination of the above. You know, learn, which is the best, and make up their mind. Okay? And I think the best idea I have for that and that, you know, it actually happens in lots of places, but it does definitely happen in sari places. For those of you from India, which is the majority of you here, we all know that if you go to buy a sari, and I hope the boys and the men are not buying too many of them, basically, that's how a store looks, okay, after somebody goes in, and you just throw in all the saris on the floor, and you're looking for stuff, except somebody else is trying to show you, because they don't want to let you go in and start removing stuff. So they'll say, so what are you looking for? And you give some random answer, because nobody has any clue as to what they're looking for, right? Especially in saris, right? And clothes also. So you sort of make up something, and they'll, based on that, they'll show you some. And then based on what you said with respect to that, they'll show you some other things, at the end of which you buy something and get out, right? And so So IR is being done. You know, it's not an inhuman problem. It's a very much human problem. We are always trying to make people happy without knowing what it is that they're actually looking for. Okay? We just now want computers also to do that. Okay? Now, so this is one reasonable way. This is one sort of reasonable way. The other third one is assume or impose a relevance model for everybody. One size fits all. And only computer scientists will do that. And so since it's a CS class, we shall do that, okay? So everybody shall be interested in page rank, alpha times page rank times beta times some other similarity metric is the ranking thou shalt get. Unless, you know, you keep logged on Gmail forever and ever and let us look into your, you know, deep dark secrets, then we'll start giving you the real results, okay? By the way, so the way really the relevance metric is assumed, you know, so you are computing this relevance metric, by the way, and it's assumed as one size fits all for everybody. So you take the user and you ignore the user, right? And you just look at the query. You don't also really look at the query, because page rank, it turns out, where we'll get to it, turns out is just the importance, the bare bones importance of the page. So in fact, if you just go by page rank, answer for every query is google.com. Because it has it's the site with 10.0 page rank. Okay? So just give it for everything. Which in some weird way of doing is probably reasonable, because from there you can then ask again, you know. right? So this is basically, I mean, I want you to understand this, because this is what we'll spend a huge amount of time doing. And it's important to know how silly we simplify problems to. And it's important to know why we get by with this. To some extent, we get by with this because of that sweet spot point. I think that's my understanding, but at least you can try to come up with hypotheses for this too. Okay? You can always come up with specific examples where a one-size-fits-all relevance model must fail miserably. But to be the best search engine, all you need to be is better than the other three bozos, right? One of who is about to kind of bankrupt. And so it's not that hard. Okay, so they're not necessarily solving the hardest problem which we really have. They are solving it. So this is release one, and this is kind of release two a little bit, and then we'll keep improving our relevance metric computation. But we really don't do this. By the way, I said relevance is a function of document, query, and the user, and I said most search engines, for example, ignore the user. But is it really just a function of document, query, and the user? If we are really particular about it, is it just a function of relevance? Is it just a function of document, query, and the user? It turns out one can make an argument that it's the function of the relevance of these documents is a function of the query, the user, and the documents D0 to DK that you have already shown them. Okay? Because while the very first document is probably your best guess as to what they're interested in, the second document has to be the one that's most different from the first document that is still also high enough in terms of, you know, similarity. Okay? So the real ranking that you need to do is to assess this relevance function, which you can see is hard. So thankfully, we ignore this, we also ignore this, we more or less ignore this, at least for the page rank part, and then give very fast ranking. Okay? That's what we will wind up doing. So the difficulty is in designing ranking methods. We want a ranking algorithm that captures the user's relevance metric. Only the user's relevance metric is not fully captured by the short keyword query. Whereas when the query has 10 words limit, for example, there is no way it can capture what it is that the user is looking for. So we hypothesize what might be underlying the user's relevance judgment, we the search engine, and then we base that hypothesis on sort of the similarity of words, similarity of co-citation, popularity of document, and then just hope that our hypotheses are good. Hope. Okay? And it's hard to optimize algorithms with respect to hope in general. Okay? But that's what we try to do in IR. Okay? And I like this quote because, in a sense, only the user, and even that, may not know what they're looking for. This is a Robert Frost poem saying, we dance around in a ring and suppose, that is we the search engines, but the secret sits in the middle and knows. So the user knows what they're looking for, but they would not tell you. And they're essentially like the Dilbert boss are saying, we'll tell you when you are not making us happy. And then, you know, you have to find out what we're doing. And this marginal relevance is this point that I won't go into again. And the last thing for today, and then we'll come back to it next class, is if in fact what you're trying to do is optimize with respect to this hypothesis that you have as to what the user is looking for or not, and you, search engine one, think similarity of words is the most important thing, search engine two thinks that this is the most important thing, search engine three thinks that all of these are crap or something else is most important, how do you figure out who is right? How do you figure out who is right? The boss is the user who is searching. So you are supposed to show the answers to the user and ask the users, do you like them? Okay? And so basically what you have is this kind of a scenario the green circle is, this is the universe of documents. The green circle is the documents that the retrieval system returned with respect to a query. The red circle is the set of documents that the user actually thinks are relevant for her query. Ignore for now gradations on relevance. Assume that all things are relevant or not relevant, binary relevance. So the red ones are all relevant, green ones are all returned by the search engine. Then clearly the most important point is what's happening here and how big is this intersection. Okay, the bigger this intersection, the more relevant results you are providing the user. But there is an easy way of increasing the intersection, which is return that every time. Return the entire set of documents every time, and you have increased the intersection to the maximum possible, because everything you are looking for is a subset of these documents. Okay, so there's a problem there. You need to stop that from happening. So you wind up having two different measures, precision and recall. Okay, precision is how often, what percentage of the documents the retrieval system gave are actually relevant. If you are precise, when you speak, you make sense. Okay, the best way of getting precision is like most of you, don't say a thing. Okay, just keep staring at me and I must think that you're extremely smart. Okay, recall on the other hand is saying how many right things did you actually say. The best way of increasing the recall is to not stop. Keep saying something or other and other and other, and then by just the law of large numbers you would have said something right. Okay, so you have precision for us is this piece divided by this entire set. And recall is this, and then the recall is this piece divided by this entire red circle. And now of course there are two measures, not one measure to optimize. So it's a multi-objective optimization problem. You do know lots and lots of problems where there are two measures that are to be optimized. For example, when you try to travel, you want to get a cheap flight which takes the least amount of time and gives free drinks, which obviously is not happening anymore. Okay, and how do you get that? And what I want to stop for today is to point out that search engines and retrieval systems have to care about precision and recall, and need to ultimately talk about comparing search engines in terms of how they deal with precision and recall. And this is a picture you can keep in mind. There are multiple methods here, and we'll come back to it. And you can, for each method, you can draw a precision recall curve. And what we are looking for is, I would say one method is better than another if its precision recall curve is above the other one at every point. Okay? We will come back to this next one.